The Guardian.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
What with the general election and a whole new consensus politics to get used to, it's been a long, hard and rather cheerless summer term. But school's nearly out and it's time to stock up on your summer reading. We, on the literary sections of both The Guardian and The Observer, have been canvassing the great and the good for their tips. The editors of both will be joining me. But perhaps the thing to do is just to sit still for a while. Easier said than done, as the writer Tim Parks will explain later. Or you could lose yourself in a page-turner, and what better than the latest novel from Scott Turow, who has taken 23 years to come up with the sequel to Presumed Innocent, which launched a whole new genre, the legal thriller. Here he is with a passage from the opening of the book.
A man is sitting on a bed. He is my father. The body of a woman is beneath the covers. She was my mother. This is not really where the story starts or how it ends, but it is the moment my mind returns to, the way I always see them. According to what my father will soon tell me, he has been there, in that room, for nearly 23 hours, except for bathroom breaks. Yesterday he awoke, as he does most weekdays, at 6:30, and could see the mortal change as soon as he glanced back at my mother, just as his feet had found his slippers. He rocked her shoulder, touched her lips, he pumped the heel of his palm against her sternum a few times, but her skin was cool as clay. Her limbs were already moving in a piece, like a mannequin's. He will tell me he sat then, in a chair across from her. He never cried. He thought, he will say. He does not know how long, except that the sun had moved all the way across the room when he finally stood again and began to tidy obsessively. He will say he put the 3 or 4 books she was always reading back on the shelf. He hung up the clothes she had a habit of piling on the chaise in front of her dressing mirror, then made the bed around her, pulling the sheets tight, folding the spread down evenly, before laying her hands out like a doll's on the satin binding of the blanket. He threw out 2 of the flowers that had wilted in the vase on her night table and straightened the papers and magazines on her desk. He will tell me he called no one, not even the paramedics, because he was certain she was dead and sent only a 1-line email to his assistant to say he would not be at work. He did not answer the phone, although it rang several times. Almost an entire day will have passed before he realizes he must contact me. But how can she be dead? I will ask. She was fine 2 nights ago when we were together. After a freighted second, I will tell my father, she didn't kill herself. No, he will agree at once. She wasn't in that kind of mood. It was her heart, he will say then. It had to be her heart and her blood pressure. Your grandfather died the same way. Are you going to call the police? I will ask. The police? He will say after a time. Why would I call the police? Well, Christ, Dad, you're a judge. Isn't that what you do when someone dies suddenly? I was crying by now. I didn't know when I had started. I was going to phone the funeral home, he will tell me, but I realized you might want to see her before I did that. Well, shit, well, yes, I want to see her. As it happens, the funeral home will tell us to call our family doctor, and he in turn will summon the coroner, who will send the police. Every so often, another officer will arrive and ask my father about what happened. He tells the story again and again, always the same way. What was there to think about all that time, one cop will say. My dad can have a hard way with his blue eyes, something he probably learned from his own father, a man he despised. Officer, are you married? I am, Judge. Then you know what there was to think about. Life, he will answer. Marriage. Her. The police will make him go through his account 3 or 4 more times, how he sat there and why. His response will never vary. He will answer every question in his usual contained manner, the stolid man of law who looks out on life as an endless sea. He will tell them how he moved each item. He will tell them where he spent each hour. But he will not tell anybody about the girl.
Scott Turow, reading from Innocent. Alison Flood caught up with him on a recent visit to the UK and asked how long it took for people to begin clamouring for a sequel to Presumed Innocent.
People started talking about a sequel almost as soon as Presumed Innocent was published. And I said just as quickly, I'm never going to do that. I felt it would be confining as a writer, you know, to have to write again in the same voice about the same character. And I didn't want to compete with myself. You know, I thought that whatever was novel about Presumed Innocent, I was not going to reinvent twice.
So what changed your mind?
Oh, I think what always changes authors' minds, you know, there's a saying, never trust a writer. And I suddenly had a story to tell that I really wanted to tell. And, you know, Rusty Savage was the right character for me to do that.
You begin the novel with the striking image of the man sitting on the edge of the bed with
right.
with his wife lying dead there. Did you always know that that was going to be Rusty and Barbara, or did the image come to you first?
No, the image came to me, and in thinking about it, I believe that somewhere I had seen an Edward Hopper painting called An Education in Philosophy, which shows a man sitting on a bed with a bereft expression and a woman lying, presumably sleeping, behind him. And I had scribbled on a Post-it note some kind of transformation of it. The Post-it note sat on my desk. It was a busy period. And suddenly, you know, one morning, I put down the telephone after a conversation, looked at the Post-it note, and said to myself, my God, that man is Rusty Savage. The man on the bed is Rusty Savage. The hair literally stood up on the back of my neck. And I was like, okay, well, if that's Rusty Savage, then who is the woman? You know, and how'd she die? And because of the ending of Presumed Innocent, it had a kind of justness to it that it be Barbara, Rusty's wife. And, of course, once I made that decision, I really had a story to tell. I knew exactly where I was going with this.
Did you not know from the beginning, then, who killed Barbara?
I had no idea. I do a lot of experimenting when I'm starting a book, write in different voices sometimes, snatches of dialogue, things that sort of seem to me like good ideas that work for me, that I can build scenes or even parts of a book around. And that's what I did there. And eventually, you know, the plot came whole to me after probably 6 to 8 months of fooling around.
And did you enjoy returning to these old characters that you'd created 23 years ago, Rusty and Tommy, his old enemy, who seems to have mellowed a lot in this book?
Yes.
And Sandy Stern, your enigmatic defense lawyer.
I lived with Rusty longer than any other character I've written about subsequently. The book was 6 to 7 years in the writing. So in some ways, I know him better than anybody else. And it was no problem at all. And I was even shocked by how quickly I could re-inhabit his voice. The part that was amazing to me, though, was when I got up one morning saying, how am I going to get that information out? What if I write from the prosecutor's point of view? I think I'm going to try Tommy Molto. And it flowed out of me. It ran out of me. Really, what are the second and fourth chapters of Innocent now basically were written 3 hours that morning.
Presumed Innocent was your first novel, mm-hmm. and you've written a number of novels and nonfiction mm-hmm. since then before you came to this book. What have you learned about the craft of writing in that time?
You know, I think the one thing that impressed me in the 4 rereadings I did of Presumed Innocent, especially the last one. I always thought when I was writing it that it was, you know, what I called a Bauhaus book. In other words, that, you know, form would follow function. Everything was in the book for a reason. And when I picked it up again, I found it incredibly digressive, full of, you know, all kinds of, you know, great little anecdotes, some of them stolen from life, some of them invented. And you know, Innocent does not permit itself the same kinds of liberties.
So you think you've become faster moving in your writing then? Kind of paring it down to the point more?
Yeah, I mean, there are fewer big words in Innocent. I'm a little bit simpler and more direct, just a little bit. You know, you cannot keep from being yourself.
Well, tell us how you managed to fit writing in with your day job as a partner in a law firm.
Yes, I continue to promote the illusion that I work full-time as a lawyer, and it is it is an illusion. I've been a part-time lawyer since 1990. It's 20 years now. So it's not at all hard. The only real difficulty comes, since I still am a trial lawyer, when I've got to go to court, and then the writing has to be pushed aside. And that, of course, can be quite frustrating. But, you know, it's the necessity of continuing to practice law, which I still want to do.
Because of your interest in it, or because it helps with writing the novels to keep up with the latest legal happenings?
You know, I really am not trying to harvest my practice for story ideas. I, first of all, enjoy the milieu. It's like being a citizen of a small town to be a member of the criminal trial bar in a city like Chicago. And, you know, the truth is lawyers can do good things. Americans certainly don't tend to think of them that way. But, you know, I've had a lot of worthwhile projects that I'm quite proud of and where I think, you know, I was of direct aid in somebody's life in a way that that a novelist, even though I believe greatly in the power of literature, but, you know, the direct aid that a lawyer can do in the right case is significant.
Scott Turow with Alison Flood, and Presumed Innocent is out now from Mantle, a new imprint of Macmillan. Thrillers are not everyone's thing, of course, so let's look at some of the other books that feature in the summer reading specials of The Guardian Review and The Observer. I'm joined by Lisa Allardyce, editor of The Guardian Review, and Will Skidelsky, literary editor of The Observer. Lisa, you came up with a topical concept for The Guardian Summer Books recommendations. Can you explain this to us?
Well, yes, this is always the thing. It's another journalistic parlour game. Every year we try and come up with something a little bit different for summer books. We have done the most appropriate reading for whichever country you're visiting this year, the least appropriate reading for whichever country you're visiting. So we've run a whole gamut, and this year we thought it was the year of the coalition. And the idea was to choose two books that at first wouldn't necessarily seem like likely bedfellows, like Cameron and Clegg, but that somehow will work together well in your suitcase, at least for a limited time.
So for example, you get Sport and Politics rather predictably from Alistair Campbell. You get the lovely Harold Larwood cricketing biography, and Obama's The Audacity to Win. Now, there's no message in that at all, is there? What other lovely matches do you get?
Well, some of them played the game absolutely straight and others less so. David Peace used it as an example to have a rant against the coalition, and he said that his coalition books will remain The Holy Bible and The Communist Manifesto. Joseph O'Connor's is rather mischievous. He says he's going to be revisiting two acclaimed masterworks by leading English storytellers, the Alistair Campbell Diaries and Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach. One is a somewhat controversial work about a tender love affair, a troubled honeymoon and the loneliness of marriage. The other is On Chesil Beach.
Ba-boom.
Ba-boom.
Will, I'm going to just move it over to you now. There's a general sense in both these sections of people wanting to make sense of what's happened in politics over the last few months, isn't there? Not necessarily through, you know, party political books.
Yeah, well, I think it was quite striking that, you know, alongside the sort of, shall we say, lighter typical summary choices, there were quite a lot of current affairs books and, you know, and more sort of philosophical books.
Like Whoops,
the
John
Lanchester. Well, there have been so many books about the crisis, and one book that was chosen by one of our contributors, Tim Adams, was Whoops by John Lanchester, which is, you know, one of the most entertaining and clear accounts of the credit crunch. We had a reader response as well, and another book that was chosen was Fool's Gold by Gillian Tett, which again is an excellent excellent account of the banking crisis. But then more broadly as well, there was a sort of rather serious side to many of the choices. Sally Vickers, for example, chose The Uses of Pessimism by Roger Scruton, which wouldn't be my choice to read by the beach.
Lisa, going back to these pairings, I rather like the idea of Margaret Drabble setting off with Why Not Socialism by G.A. Cohen in one pocket and Roberto Saviano's Gomorrah, Italy's Other Mafia, in the other. which he describes as a terrifying description of what happens to us without communal interest.
It's lovely, isn't it? And we did invite a representative swathe of politicians to take part. And as they say on Newsnight, the coalition leaders sadly declined. We do have a coalition represented in the Miliband brothers. I particularly like David Miliband's, who gamely has chosen Mark Oaten's coalition, A History of Coalition Making Since 1850. And then he says that he's going to kick back with a beer after the kids have gone to bed with Amos's pregnant widow, which is a rather nice image I have. The pregnant widow actually came up several times, which is rather good because Amos got a bit of a kicking in the reviews, but everybody is saying they're still interested to see what he's got to say.
Now, Will, were there other books that came up more than you would have expected or more than others?
Well, a novel that seems to be very much of the moment is, I'll probably pronounce his name wrong, Christopher Chalkas's.
Christos Chalkas. Since he appeared on this very podcast a couple of weeks ago.
The Slap, which is set at an Australian barbecue, and one of the guests slaps a child in it, kind of narrated from multiple viewpoints. I was pleased to see that Luke Jennings's book, Blood Knots, which is a memoir about fishing and Englishness by the Observer's dance critic, Luke Jennings, got a couple of mentions, which is very pleasing because he's a lovely writer.
One thing that seems to have come out of this, Lisa, is that summer isn't necessarily a time for reading the latest thing. It can be a time for catching up on things you've missed out on, can't it? So we've got, I think it was in The Observer, Zadie Smith saying she's only just got round to Richard Holmes's The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. Sally Vickers suggests, even for much further back, actually, Making Conversation by Christine Longford from Persephone. At least you know when people suggest that sort of book, they're not log-rolling for their friends.
Well, quite. And how many for ordinary people, in a way, they're not necessarily only interested in the book that's out this year. So in our feedback, we had recommendations for Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, which, was last year's book. Then the year before that, David Lodge's Death Sentence.
Now, am I right in sensing that a bit of melancholy in some of these choices? It seems to me that they're quite there. I mean, maybe it's just about the sort of books that are coming out at the moment. For example, Sally Vickers in The Obs opted for John Suchet's
book about dementia. Yes.
His wife's dementia. We've got the
Audrey Niffenegger chose Joan Didion as well, didn't she?
The Year of Magical Thinking. And Jim Perrin was chosen by a couple of people. He's actually best known as a climber and adventurer, but it's about the aftermath of the deaths of his son and his wife. Lisa, what about the fiction recommendations?
Well, as I say, Amos's Pregnant Widow, I don't know if it's just the idea of sort of naked girls beside a pool in 70s Italy is alluring to readers. But there are also novels, one that I've noticed everybody seems to be reading a lot at the moment is One Day, The Slap, Skippy Dies.
Will, reader feedback. You had a column the week after you ran your summer reading feature asking readers for their recommendations. What did they come up with?
Well, I mean, some less surprising, like Fool's Gold by Gillian Tett, as I mentioned, Wolf Hall. But we did have some rather nice, surprising ones. One reader recommended Rafiq Sharmi's The Dark Side of Love, which is was a Syrian novel, sort of epic novel. And I haven't actually read it, but everything I've read about it made me think it's sort of fantastic. So, it was nice to get some unexpected choice. Another reader recommended, if you like Stieg Larsson, try a much better Swedish writer, Johan Theorin, author of Echoes from the Dead and The Darkest Room, which again is, taking you beyond what might be expected.
And I put out an appeal on Twitter as well, and I got quite a wide range, ranging from Kieran Desai's 1999 novel, Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard, which Raha said was wonderfully evocative to read in the hot, sticky summer, to Too Big to Fail by Andrew Sorkin, which takes you behind the scenes of the 2008 Wall Street crash. Our own personal recommendations.
Well, I recommended a novel called The Imperfectionists by Tom Rackman, which is the first novel set at a decaying newspaper in Rome. And it's, I think, a brilliant novel. It came out earlier this year and is just terribly entertaining and well-written. Perfect beach read, in fact. But I've read another novel which I think is absolutely brilliant and is also about, would be a perfect novel to take travelling, which is In a Strange Room by the South African novelist Damon Galgut. And it's a sort of memoir stroke novel about three journeys he has undertaken during his life, and it's an extraordinarily powerful book, I think. I think really one of the books of the year.
It should be, I think,
a contender for the Booker.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if it is on the Booker long list, which is announced in a couple of weeks' time. Because, of course, whether it's memoir or travel fiction.
Maybe it will be one of those ones that falls between the cracks of a genre.
Lisa, how about you?
I'm going to stick with my coalition theme and taking advantage of one of the privileges of the job. I have a great big fat advance proof copy of Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom, which I'm very much looking forward to getting stuck into on holiday. To pair with that, I'm going to take Helen Simpson's slim and aptly titled exquisite collection of short stories, In Flight Entertainment.
Just be careful which story you read when you're on the plane. Let me just warn you, give you that little warning. And I'm going to go with the great A.S. Byatt and recommend The Hare with the Amber Eyes, which I know I've been going on about a bit, but it is so fantastic. It's by Edmund Duval. Lisa and Will, thank you very much for coming in. Now, one of the books recommended, by the great nature writer Richard Mabey, no less, was Tim Park's Teach Us to Sit Still, A Skeptic's Search for Health and Healing. It just so happens that we spotted it too and asked him to tell us about it. He began by reading a passage about one of his exotic encounters with two doctors of Ayurvedic medicine.
"Well, for immediate relief, we could address the symptoms," he eventually began. "For that, I would prescribe an enema of sesame oil and various herbs to be held in the colon for as long as you can manage, certainly not less than 40 minutes. I was silent. "On the other hand," he sat back and looked at me in the eyes, his face was frank, "this is a problem you will never get over, Mr. Parks, until you confront the profound contradiction in your character." I can't recall being more surprised by a single remark in all my life. "Ah," I said at last, "there is a tussle in your mind." I sat still. I had wanted a different story to challenge the official medical version. I was getting it. "What actually causes all this pain?" I asked. "It is blocked vata. That is an energy that flows in the body," his wife explained. "One of the five elements. It balances others and needs to be balanced by them. When the balance goes wrong, then the vata is blocked and causes pain. It is this mental tussle that blocks the vata," the doctor said. I reflected. "So what is the tussle about?" "Ha, good question," the doctor smiled. "A tussle like this is not really about anything," his wife explained. "It is part of the prakruti." They began to explain to me what prakruti was: the amalgamation of inherited and acquired traits coming together to form the personality. If those traits were at odds and the two couldn't mix, you'd be in trouble. "Let's assume that you're right," I said. "How would one go about sorting out something like that?" I sensed as I spoke that "go about" and "sorting out" were the wrong terms. Somebody who knew Ayurvedic medicine would not have used them. Dr. Hazan was weighing me up. "There is no prescribed cure as such. It is hard to treat the prakruti, but a good way to start would be with a birth chart." I had noticed some publications on astrology in the waiting room. The doctor could see my skepticism. "You don't believe in our connections with the stars, Mr. Parks." I shook my head.
Tim Parks reading from Teach Us to Sit Still. Before we stepped into the studio, Tim described to me the agonising and embarrassing condition that set him off on his search. So I began by asking him rather bluntly if this was basically a book about a prostate problem.
"Well, you know, it seemed like it was about a prostate problem. I had a very complicated array of abdominal pains and pains in the upper legs and so on. I also had the kind of urinary dysfunctions, a kind of nocturnal micturation that is normally associated with prostate problems. But then when they started exploring me with their various tests, it was discovered that, in fact, I was in perfect prostate's health.
One aspect of this book is a sort of medical horror show, really, isn't it? And my reviewer, Stuart Jeffries, who absolutely loved the book, said he read it, nevertheless, with crossed legs.
Well, you know, a number of men do seem to be extremely susceptible, you know, and describing a cystoscopy where they use a rigid instrument to go up with a small orifice.
With illustrations of the instruments and the orifice.
Well, that's just I just drop in a little image of the instrument just to cheer the readers that they're not there themselves, you know. The images in the book are actually quite important. But I think what was interesting to me was that as it went on, I became very aware that I had to stop trying to solve the problem by just kind of rushing off to the doctor the way you take the car to the mechanics and get it fixed. And it did take an awful long time, but I began to realise that I had to really, really look at this pain and think about it.
So you basically then had to make a journey into yourself to find out what the problem was or to sort yourself out.
Well, you know, I'm not that clever. I spent an enormous amount of time on the net. I discovered that women had the same problems. I think that was another big breakthrough moment when you realise that you're reading on the net descriptions of your problems, which are absolutely the same coming from women. So the whole prostate thing just disappears immediately. And then I finally did have the immense good fortune to come across this book with the weirdest possible title, a headache in the pelvis. I mean, a kind of title guaranteed to make the book not immediately findable on the net. And this book, very interestingly, began to field a whole series of ideas about the way that a certain kind of tense and stressful lifestyle over many years could lead someone to have internal muscular walls that were atrophying and that were causing nerves passing through them to send painful messages and so on. I was just immensely sceptical of this as of anything. But these were the first guys who actually described the symptoms and who actually took the pain seriously. Because one thing, when doctors see that pain is not causing you to fall to pieces, I mean, I wasn't kind of fading away, you know. I could still go running and I was still doing all my work and stuff. I was just in pain. I mean, I couldn't actually sit down for quite a long while. But these guys took the pain seriously and they described it very accurately, so I began to believe that they were onto something. And they basically offered, apart from anal massage in California, which is just a classically Californian adventure, which I didn't go on because I picked up this book in spring when I was very busy at the university and so on. But I did follow their prescriptions for quite complex breathing exercises and so on. And this did, that was the real breakthrough, because it seemed to me such a minor thing to learn a breathing exercise, but actually they were a bit more than breathing exercises. It was about emptying the mind of words. It was about reaching a state where the mind is in a relationship with the body without language and so on. And I was simply astonished at the effect that this had on me when I managed to learn how to do that. I must say it was very, very difficult to learn. I could easily have given up after the third or fourth hour where nothing really happens. And then later somebody explained to me, look, this is a form of meditation. And I realized that the doctors had very wisely eliminated from this book almost every possible suggestion that what you were doing was actually coming from a completely different culture, because they were very aware that people like me would... I mean, if you stuck the word meditation in front of me, I just say, I don't want to have anything to do with that.
Now, you cite a lot of other writers, don't you? Like, for example, Thomas Hardy.
One of the things that I found about this illness was that whereas you'd think I should have been thinking about drugs and kind of checking on the net, or which I was to a certain extent, but I would find that the most pleasure would come when my mind meandered looking at paintings or thinking about writers that I was writing about. And I remember thinking about Hardy and realizing that Hardy had had a very similar condition. He had a mysterious bladder inflammation, as they called it. Obviously, they had no way of actually examining his bladder at the time. And it did sound extremely similar. He also had problems sitting down. He had to lie down for a long time, rather, or stand up. And Beckett, obviously another man who had all kinds of physical problems that were clearly related to his... although probably with Beckett, to his more immediate psychological situation rather than to a simple stress, like physical muscular stress. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting in the book to reflect on the fact that the whole business of using language and telling stories all the time could be taking some of these people into the same territory. I mean, another one's Coleridge, obviously, who's considered the greatest hypochondriac of all time, but I'm not so sure that he was. I mean, I think he did have all kinds of serious problems.
Now, use of the word hypochondriac is interesting to me, because you wouldn't say necessarily that Hardy was a hypochondriac.
No.
He was somebody who dealt with pain, whereas Coleridge maybe is a... He complained
more.
Well,
you know, I'm not sure that I agree with that. Again, you know, one of the interesting things there is you're reading modern academics writing about Coleridge, and they're saying, well, you know, he had these pains, but nothing ever happened. So he was a hypochondriac. But that's not actually the case. There's lots of forms of chronic pain, even back pain, in fact, particularly back pain, you know, which is notoriously painful and notoriously has no particular outcome in terms of a pathology. So I think they're being a little unkind to Coleridge. But I do think that what they're right about with Coleridge was that he did rather go overboard in loving describing pain, that it was an interesting thing for him to try and bring words to pain. So I think there was an element there of kind of luxuriating linguistically in some attempt to chase down these elusive pains he was having.
And do you think that it has affected the tone and the temperament of your writing, this transformation of you?
Well, it's certainly in this book, yes. I mean, I think there are some scenes in this book that I couldn't have written
such
before.
As?
It was a huge challenge to write the meditation scenes towards the end of the book. Because it's very, very difficult. I mean, because you're basically... Meditation is something that detaches itself from a wordless state. And once in that state, it seems pointless to try to describe it. So you're talking around something. You're talking around the ineffable. So, yeah, certainly in the next book I'm writing, I'm very aware that I'm doing something that's come out of this. And that it is rather different, yeah. But also, it's still alas me, you know.
And the big question, are you free of pain now?
Absolutely free of pain for about the last year. Very occasionally get kind of shadows of it coming back, you know, sort of memories of it. But I know how to get out of it immediately, yeah.
The great and, we devoutly hope, pain-free Tim Parks. Teach Us to Sit Still is out now from Harville Secker. And that's it from us on this edition of the Books Podcast. We'll be back next week. Meanwhile, in the Guardian Saturday Review this weekend, you can catch up with all those summer reading recommendations. Please add your suggestions at guardian.co.uk/books. In the Observer's new review on Sunday, Andrew Rawnsley is one of the first reviewers to catch up with Peter Mandelson's new memoir. And on the website, look out for this month's Guardian Book Club podcast with Brett Easton Ellis. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.